To quote the London Daily Mirror, most rock groups can boast of one or two clever blokes. In Queen, they're all clever. Queen is one of England's new and most exciting rock groups. Can you tell us what Queen is all about?
It's basically a rock and roll band with lots of harmonies, lots of everything.
Can you safely stay in one place? Can you stay in one bag today and be safe?
No. We're not. That's one of the things that I think people can't put us into is one category. We've got so many sort of... There's a lot of ingredients that make up Queen, and you can't put your finger on it, really. It's one of the most difficult questions to start off with, really.
I read about Queen. I read about how that you like to do albums, but then when you're on the stage, something happens. You feel that a stage should be an entire show rather than just a concert.
That's true. They're two entirely different concepts. They're two sort of spheres of us. And when we're in a studio, we really work for the album and go that way. And when we're working on stage, it's a totally different trip.
Is this the future of where rock is going to? Are you predicting something? I seem to be looking 20 years from now when I watch your work, Fred.
I'm just me when I'm on stage. I'm just me. I'm not sort of laying down any message or predicting anything. I'm just having fun on stage and just trying to put across our music, which is cool.
Everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And this week we have on the show Greg Brooks, the official archivist for the band Queen. Greg joins us this week as a fellow record collector who somehow managed to finagle his way into the world's greatest job, managing the massive archive for one of the world's most beloved bands. Greg speaks to us today about the incredible detailed approach he takes for ensuring the original Queen master tapes, video, rare pressings, and paraphernalia are preserved for generations to come. He also discusses how the Queen team create new releases, such as Queen Live at the Rainbow 74 or Queen On Air. It's a two-part discussion, and this is only part one. Part two should be available shortly, so make sure your subscription settings for the Vinyl Guide podcast are up to date so you get notified as soon as the new episode is available. And this week, we're sponsored by Black Pug Records. Check out their catalog of original Australian vinyl pressings you cannot get elsewhere at facebook.com/blackpugrecords. Like them, follow them, do whatever you got to do, but get with them at facebook.com/blackpugrecords. And we're also brought to you this week by groovewasher.com. Clean vinyl prolongs your records and preserves your gear. Pick up the best manual record cleaning system on earth for only $29.95 at groovewasher.com. And with that, let's get into the first of our two-part Queen extravaganza with Greg Brooks, official archivist for the band Queen.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Alrighty, check one, two. This thing is on. Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for downloading. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. Glad you could join us today, and I hope you're ready for a big one. Ooh, I've been saving this interview for a couple of months, just waiting for the right time to share. And that time is now. It's today. So I'm so stoked. This is the first of our two-part interview with Greg Brooks, official archivist for the band Queen. Now, I didn't mean for this to become a two-parter, but Greg and I spoke for so long, and it was so damn interesting, I figured you guys would love it too. Greg essentially got his dream job working with his favorite band, archiving their recordings. And what was originally meant to be a six-month job has now gone on for 20 years. And he's not only looking after audio recordings, but of course the Queen video content, pictures, interviews, magazine articles, press clippings, stage apparel, handwritten correspondence, and of course the official Queen Vault of Vinyl Records. Plus, Greg is also part of the team that sources and helps put together what they term archive-led releases, stuff like the 2015 release of Queen, A Night at the Odeon, Hammersmith, or the recent Queen On Air. That's quite fascinating, especially for us record collectors, since we all have a bit of obsessive-compulsive disorder and love not only the music, but also the act of collecting, the act of filing and catalog, and of course, being proud that we're custodians of music. So Greg has, in my estimation, the best of both worlds, not only working for a legendary band like Queen, but also getting into the details, the ideation, the organization of how this band's legacy will be shaped, as well as participating in the conceptualization of new products. Now, it's all quite fascinating, so get your cup of coffee or tea or whatever you need for this two-part series with Greg Brooks, official archivist for the band Queen. Now, also, just a quick reminder, I want you guys to share this podcast, especially to your friends who love music, and especially Queen. Help someone get involved in podcasting. Now, it's not all that easy to understand and set up. It's a fairly new concept for most people, especially folks like me who love vinyl records, maybe trapped a little bit in some of those old formats. So if you got a buddy who enjoys hearing or discussing music, but they're also a bit technologically challenged, take a few moments, tell them about this podcast, and help get them set up on their phone or computer. Now, it not only helps your friend, but it broadens the Vinyl Guide community, and that sort of helps and assists in just making the world a better place. Now, did that sound pompous? I didn't mean it to say the Vinyl Guide makes the world a better place, but you helping your friends find something they like and listen to, like podcasts, is a nice thing to do. So, this week, I'm giving you all homework. Go out and find at least one person to show them on their mobile device how to get a podcast, and hopefully the one you start them with is the Vinyl Guide. All right, that's your homework. I'm going to check back next week, make sure you all did it. And by the way, you could do a whole bunch of people for some extra credit. All right, that's it. Let's start today's episode. This is the first of a two-part series with Greg Brooks, official archivist for the band Queen, right after this. Hey everyone, there is a record shop that you all need to know about.
Black Pug Records. Black Pug Records.
Can be found online at facebook.com/Black Pug Records. Now the shop itself is in Islington, New South Wales, which is in Newcastle. So anyone around Sydney or the Newcastle area can easily get to
Black Pug Records
and walk in and check it all out for yourself. But here's why our national and international listeners should know about
Black Pug Records.
And that's because
Black Pug Records
has a regular supply of killer original pressing Australian vinyl. Get yourself the AC/DC original pressings on Albert Productions, which you've always wanted. Or pick up an OG Midnight Oil, or In Excess, Crowded House, Angels, or Cold Chisel pressings. All original and ready to ship worldwide. Get original Australian punk records from Hard-Ons or Meanies or Nick Cave or Psych Collectibles like Mountains of Madness or Spectrum Part 1. If you want an original Australian pressing vinyl, the shop to call is
Black Pug Records.
Like them on Facebook at facebook.com/Black Pug Records. That's facebook.com/Black Pug Records. The one-stop shop for original Australian vinyl. Hey there, you vinyl record maniacs. Yes, I'm talking to you. You know you need to keep your records clean before playing them. In fact, any sort of dust or debris on the record surface can affect your sound, or worse, ruin your gear. Your record stylus is a sliver thin piece of diamond costing $50 or $100 or more. Dirt will wear the styluses unevenly, and that will put wear and tear on your vinyl and potentially ruin your collection. So, don't be a dummy. Get yourself a record cleaner. And in my estimation, there is no better manual record cleaner than the Groove Washer Record Cleaning Kit. The Groove Washer gets deep into the grooves, lifting all that deep-rooted grime out of your records so they look and sound their very best. And the great thing about Groove Washer is cleaning kits start at only $29.95 at groovewasher.com. That is amazing. Other record cleaning kits go for four or five times that cost. And the record cleaning machines, oh boy, those can run you into the thousands. Groove Washer can be used and enjoyed by everyone for as little as $29.95. And great news for you record retailers, you can stock Groove Washer in your store. Head over to groovewasher.com for dealer and wholesale pricing. So, what did we learn today? Don't be a knucklehead. Clean your records regularly with the Groove Washer record cleaning system today, starting at only $29.95 at groovewasher.com. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA.
Hey, this is Jonathan Colton. Please check out my new album, Solid State. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
All right, that is going to be a great episode. Jonathan Colton is joining us here on The Vinyl Guide, or as his fans call him, Joco. He's going to be talking about vinyl, of course, and digital rights management, and of course, his new album, Solid State. So make sure you set your Vinyl Guide subscription settings correctly so you don't miss that episode. Now, before we start the discussion with Greg Brooks, here's something kind of funny, maybe a bit scary, but very cool. After we did the interview with Greg, he and I were chit-chatting kind of on the side, and he mentioned something to the effect that he didn't want to give any misinformation because, quote, Brian or Roger may call me up on it. To which I said, do you think Brian May or Roger Taylor will actually listen to this podcast? And he replied, yeah, there's a good chance they will. So this is quite a revelation to me, knowing that right now, Brian May and or Roger Taylor are out there somewhere in this world listening to me say these words. So if they are, let me just quickly say this. Brian, Roger, apologies for getting all fanboy on you, but oh my God, your music is so awesome. My friend Chuck and I used to drive around as teenagers listening to cassette tapes of Night at the Opera, News of the World, all the albums, really. And the Queen work really helped form our young brains, our musical tastes, and our diversity, which has really played a major part in our lives to this very day. In fact, Chuck, he's gone on to be a huge mega fan. He collects all sorts of Queen stuff now. And my musical taste really began with your music, and that impact continues on me to this day. And I'm now passing it on to my children, so it's kind of generational, too. So in short, on behalf of myself, Chuck, and the Vinyl Guide audience, we want to say thank you for all that wonderful music. Thank you for being brave with your art, for pushing boundaries, and most importantly, for continuing to have fun. It really comes through in the music, and it's an absolute joy to be able to share those thoughts with you. And also, I gotta say, well done on getting Greg and team to oversee the archive and help steer the Queen legacy. They have done a fantastic job. And I gotta tell you, Greg is a great guest and a good guy, but he was also very protective of the Queen activities and an absolute soldier for you guys. So you really couldn't have designed a better person to be part of the Queen team than Greg. And of course, Brian, Roger, either of you have an open invitation to join us here on The Vinyl Guide anytime. With Greg coming on the show to speak to us about Queen, it's only fair that you guys get an opportunity to come on the show and speak about Greg. You could talk about his work habits, the stuff he leaves in the break room. It's all up for discussion. Reach out anytime. All right, that's it. Let's start part one of our interview with Greg Brooks, official archivist for the band Queen. So today on The Vinyl Guide, we are talking with Greg Brooks, a guy who, in my opinion, has one of the best jobs in the world. Greg is the official archivist for the band Queen, a job which I imagine has this brilliant mix of music appreciation, the organization of music for one of the most beloved bands in the world, and some creativity when it comes to working on various projects. Greg, am I off base? Am I perhaps romanticizing what may be just another boring office job?
No, I would agree with what you said. I think it's a very privileged job and an unusual job. And most of the time, I wouldn't say every second of every day, I love the job and its diversity and all the things that it entails are pretty great, really. I can't complain.
Now, how do you become the official archivist for Queen?
Well, I should imagine anyone who has become an archivist for an artist as big as Queen has a different story. And mine is unusual-ish, I think. What happened was back in, I think it was 95, the Beatles had released their anthology CDs and vinyl. And they'd gone into the archive and they'd done a pretty thorough job of offering some of those recordings. And I heard that and it got me thinking about Queen and their archive. And so one day I spontaneously wrote to Jim Beach, Queen's manager. I knew the address because I had been in contact with the fan club for some years and the fan club rang me quite often to ask me questions. So I knew how to get to Jim. And I just wrote a quite a casual letter one day and said, I understand that the Queen archive may need some organization. It's not in the best situation it could be. And if you ever were to consider doing that, perhaps you'd consider me. I've got some ideas on how I would log tapes and create databases and so on. And the timing was good, Nate. He came back and said, well, funnily enough, we are considering doing something with our archive and we realize that it's not in the best order that it could be in terms of organization. So how would you do it? Give me some details, which I did. And then he sent a colleague along to meet me to see if that person would be happy to work with someone like me. That was Justin Shirley Smith, who I've since become good friends with. And he's been my close working colleague for the last 20 years. So he obviously gave me a good report and I began the job they kept me waiting after that interview till 97. And then they said to me, or Jim said, if you do the job in 6 months, you finish it in 6 months, we'll give you a bonus. And that was 20 years ago.
So you never got that bonus, I imagine.
I didn't get the bonus, but I did get the bonus of an extra 19 and a half years and still going.
So when you wrote that letter, you didn't know much about the Queen Archive, did you? It was just kind of a bit of a shot in the dark?
No, correct. I had no idea what to expect or the scale of it or the diversity of the formats or what condition they would be in and where they would be and what needed doing. For example, certain Queen boxes from the original session recordings would have working titles of songs rather than the title that they would ultimately become. So you might have a song called Woolly Hat, which later becomes Backchat. So I thought of things such as I would give each song its own unique code. So no matter how it was referred to on a tape or on a track sheet, I would give, for example, Backchat its own unique code, a four-letter code, and that's what we would use each time. So when you go into the database that we created specifically for this project, Justin and I, you would enter that code and you would find that song no matter how it was referred to. So that was the sort of thing I told Jim about, and obviously labeling the tapes and giving each one a project prefix, some general basics, but imperative if you want to find all the right tapes.
Do you have any background in the archiving arts, or what led you to believe that this was something you could do?
Well, historically, I had had various jobs that I wasn't particularly happy in, and a few jobs that I was decidedly unhappy in, and they were generally admin computer input, or in fact the jobs I'd done immediately prior to Queen, well, I was a recruitment consultant. So I was used to organizing things and knowing where to find, in that instance, find the right person for the right job in the right location with the right qualifications. But more than that, I had been a Queen fan since 1976. So even by the time I'd written to Jim, I'd been a fan for 20 years. I'd written a book on Queen's live shows, which had not long been published. So that went in my favor. They obviously knew that I knew my subject and that I was pretty thorough and meticulous from the research in that book, which was, by the way, pre-internet days. So I was relying on lists from fans and research material I'd gathered, and every magazine or newspaper article I could get my hands on. So by the time I met with Jim, I'm sure he'd done his homework and knew that I was the kind of person that if I took a job on, I would be very thorough.
So I imagine just by the reputation and what I know of the band, they're probably very protective of who gets into the inner circle. Did you go through some sort of vetting process before they allowed you to come in and have that sort of access?
Of sorts, yes, I did. I was vetted, but only so far as they rang a few people that knew me. The lady that ran the fan club at the time, in fact still runs a fan club, Jackie Smith, they rang her and asked her, she told me this later, of course, do you know Greg? What's he like? Is he a trustworthy person? Does he shout his mouth off? Can he keep secrets? Can he be discreet? And is he professional? Those kind of questions. They rang another friend of mine, Jim Jenkins, who was known to the band, a big fan from way back, since day one, really, and various people. And also at the time, in 1995, I was working on a BBC radio documentary. And the guy that I was working with and helping with that project, they asked him as well, actually. They said, you've been working with Greg, what's he like? And this chap said, oh, he's been very accommodating and very generous with his time, and he's not asked for anything. So all those things collectively, I think, painted a favorable picture, and they met me, grilled me for an hour or so, I remember, in London, and then offered me the job and said, well, hold fire, we could be some time. And it was that they made me wait about a year and a half. So for those 18 months, every time the phone rang, you can imagine, I was leaping on the phone, hoping it was Jim Beach. At that time, to be honest, I was beginning to despair about my job and my career and my choices, and thinking, really, if somebody gives me a chance, I'll do a great job. But I've got to be interested. And the work I was doing at the moment, I had no interest in. I'd always wanted to work for Queen. I had thought about approaching them before, but never thought it was worth doing. But that time I did, having made the first approach, I was pretty desperate that they took me on. I really wanted to get in there and prove myself and do some good work.
So you get offered the job. Day one, when you start working for the Queen Archive, what were the conditions of tapes and memorabilia and things that are part of the archive? Were they scattered all over the place? What did you find when you walked in there on day one?
Day one, I was dealing with only audio tapes, and the audio tapes were in no particular order. There was many, many hundreds of tapes in a room in quite a disordered state. So I took them away from that place to a safer place, or we did. There was a small team of us that removed those tapes from that damp location. We moved them to a temperature-controlled, humidity-controlled, safe area. And then I began to sort them into projects as best I could. And then I began numbering the tapes. So, for example, I would gather together all the Night at the Opera multi-tracks, and then all the Night at the Opera stereo tapes, and then the U-matic tapes, and so on and so forth, right down to DATs and CDs and cassettes. And then I would number them. And then when I did that entire process for every audio tape, I then began logging them into the database that we created.
Were the tapes labeled, or did you have to go through a whole process of then listening to a lot of the unlabeled, unmarked stuff?
That's a good question. Some of them were labeled, but not in a very helpful way. So, for example, I could pick up a tape that might say D66, which means nothing. And that ultimately, it transpired that the letter D represented a Night at the Opera, i.e. the fourth project, Queen's fourth album. So I decided that I would give every tape a prefix. So in that instance, NATO, Night at the Opera. So it would be NATO 1 to NATO 200 or whatever. So at the very least, you would know that NATO 6 was from a Night at the Opera project. So that was obviously a first thing to do, where possible. And it was possible to determine most tapes and what project they were, although there were a few things that would be changed later. I remember, for example, thinking that tapes that we later established were from the Rainbow concerts from 74, I initially logged as Queen 2 because of the date and the tracks before it was evident that they are actually live and not a studio session. So, you know, I logged lots of things. I was hurrying along because I thought I only had 6 months and wanted to cover as much ground as I could. If I had known that I had 20 years, I probably would have done things slightly differently. But anyway, we had all these tapes, and in most cases, it was very clear or partially clear what the content was. So a tape might say that it contained four recordings of Somebody to Love, and later we might find out that it had three and one had been taken away. So it did require listening to lots of these tapes, and the listening came later. When we were transferring, we would make a reference copy, and I would work from the reference copy rather than having to play the original precious analog tapes and risk damaging that tape in an unnecessary way. So we would transfer the tape, at the same time create a reference, and I would listen and log from that. So yes, it did become necessary to hear many tapes. So you can imagine the process took a lot of time. And then the notes that I made went into the database, you know, what I was hearing as opposed to what was maybe written on the box. And sometimes that differed. I logged and labeled all these things and put a physical label on. Later on, we would photograph the tapes because lots of instances, things were written on the tape or the box or the track sheet in pencil. And after 30 years, the pencil begins to deteriorate. So you want to capture it and preserve it. So we took photographs. And then obviously later on, we began the process of safety copying all these tapes, preserving them to digital formats and files. So there was an awful lot of work to do with quite a considerable number of tapes to get them to the point where we are today, where we know precisely what's on every tape, where that tape is, whether it's been copied or not, where the copy is or are. And we have photographs for most of these tapes. So we can actually access lots of information and see the tapes virtually on one's laptop without having to be in the archive.
Did you find other notes, other sort of items? Like, I would imagine, you know, when they recorded Sheer Heart Attack, they create the two the 2-inch master tape. Then they create the stereo mixdown tape. That gets transferred and backed up. And then the original tape box, it may have different notes in there. There may be different scribbles, people drawing on the box, maybe a handwritten note from Freddie, a shopping list, a packet of drugs. There could be anything that could be found inside those boxes. Any sort of surprises that you came across?
Well, you're quite right in what you say. All of the above, except for the bag of drugs. we did indeed find track sheets. Many, many multi-track boxes have a track sheet handwritten by the engineer of the day or by the band members. There would be notes and scribbles and menus and "I'm nipping down the pub, we'll be back in half an hour." Those kind of notes, or "do not touch this mix desk. If you do, you will be killed," type of messages. Lovely handwritten lyrics quite often we found. And obviously track sheets and mix details, all kinds of things that you would expect from the time. And some of these boxes, as you say, hadn't been opened for 30 years. So it was very much like going back in time to the session, opening the box, and almost like an archaeologist going into the pyramid for the first time in 2,000 years. I was opening tapes that maybe hadn't been opened for 40 years, and finding all the little notes and nuances and all those lovely little flavors of the day.
Notes on the back of a menu for a Chinese restaurant, and you could
you'd be surprised. You can imagine these four people working, furiously working away on their album and grabbing the nearest thing, maybe a piece of paper or the back of a menu, anything that was to hand, to scribble down some lyrics or some chords or some mixed details or some such thing. And then somebody's had the foresight to put that in the box and keep it. And there it remained for 30 years. So all of that stuff had to be archived. The track sheets had to be copied and preserved. Every single tiny piece of information from every tape we tried to protect and preserve, whether it was the audio or the video or the film or the writing or just the text. Every little aspect we had to think about and address.
Were any of the original tapes damaged?
No, actually. I think the worst we had was a few tapes that were water damaged. The boxes were water damaged, where there'd been a leak in the storage facility through the roof, and it would drip onto, unfortunately, a couple of, I seem to recall, News of the World tapes. So the boxes had it, but it hadn't really damaged the tape. Or in a couple of instances where there might have been some mold on a couple of tapes, it was only minor damage, and we cleaned the tape and they responded well. So no, there wasn't anything that was damaged, and certainly nothing that was irreparably damaged.
So it sounds like Queen, even in the early days, they had a bit of the foresight to take care of some of these materials, because I don't think as many bands keep as much of a record of their early stuff. It sounds like Queen at least had the foresight to protect it and to put it in some place, and the wisdom to know that, you know, this is something that we need to hold on to and take care of.
Well, that's absolutely correct. I think we're in a very unusual position with Queen in that they did keep and think to preserve more or less everything. So I've never encountered that with anyone else I've spoken to in my 20 years, and I've spoken to many archivists, and nobody has said, "Oh yes, we have all the video, all the original audio, we have more or less everything." I think we're kind of more or less on our own in that regard. Many groups have a considerable archive, but not really retained everything, and we do more or less have everything. And it's not just the audio and the video and the film. You know, we've retained all the photographs and most of the costume. And Brian has a huge memorabilia collection. He retained all of his press archive. So all of those things, as well as the music and and the visuals, all of that has been retained and archived as well. So when we take on a project like Live at the Rainbow in 1974, not only can we go back to the original multitracks audio and the stereo tapes, we can go and find the corresponding video, the 2-inch video from the night, and I can dig out the photographs from the time and the memorabilia from the time and the news press, the reviews of those concerts. So we have a pretty thorough and extensive coverage of nearly every project you could mention.
Does that extend to live shows as well? For instance, if they played Houston in 1975, can you quickly look up not only the audio of the live show, but also images, pictures, and any video or film that was associated with that?
The short answer is yes. Any concert that you care to mention, we haven't got every single Queen concert recorded by any means, but certain concerts such as Hammersmith 75, we could go and we could lay our hands on our original audio and video very quickly. And a half an hour later, I could bring a box full of photographs and press reviews and the original Brian's original tour program and concert ticket and tour laminate and posters. All of those things we could have together within an hour, more or less. So in certain instances for Queen concerts, we have original multitrack recordings. In other cases, we don't have multitracks, we only have stereo. And in other instances, we only have cassettes from the mix desk at the time when or an engineer thought to record the show just for reference, you know, just for interest. So we have got many Queen performances existing only on a very old 30 or 40 year old cassette. But though they are casual recordings, they've become quite precious because they are in many cases, and as far as I know, the only surviving recordings. So he was in the US in 76 and 77. There were probably two dozen examples where the show was recorded from the mix desk onto one of Brian's cassettes. He would put it in his little box and forget about it for 20 years until I came along and logged it and listened to it and became aware of it.
You mentioned backing up the audio and the video. Of course, the tape and even digital formats have a limited lifespan. How do you back them up? What format do you use to back them up? And then what's the process for ensuring the backups work and for backing up the backups?
Well, that question really should be aimed at our audio experts here, engineer, producer Justin Shirley Smith and Chris Fredrickson. They really take on the safety copying. But generally, I can tell you that all these precious tapes are protected and safety copied to, originally to digital tapes, and I think more recently to hard disk or both, and usually more than one copy. And those copies are stored separate to each other and obviously separately from the original masters. So we'd never have the position where you'd have the master and its safeties in the same building. That we are aware, as is any decent archive, that you separate the things and you keep various things in various places. But yeah, generally speaking, digital tapes and hard disks, I believe, is what they're most often using. And of course, they have to keep all the machines and the equipment that play those particular formats. It's all very well retaining an obscure digital format or tape from 1992, but you need to keep the means of playing that media as well. Sorry, you do need a quite a sizable archive, not just for the tapes you're keeping, but for the equipment you need if you want to hear them back.
Yeah, I could see how that would be the case with in the case of Frank Zappa, his archive, the vault where they keep the Zappa music. There's still formats that were so obscure now that they still haven't heard the audio of many of Frank's recordings that he was doing. Is that the case with Queen? Are there some formats that you guys just haven't even been able to get them to play?
Well, that's very interesting what you say about Zappa. I think because our archive is, we're not too far from central London, and whatever tape you choose, no matter how obscure it is, there's normally someone somewhere, and we have a small group of maybe 3-4 companies that we can use that if we do come across a very obscure tape, be it video or audio, someone somewhere has a machine that can play it. I don't think we've ever come across something that we cannot access at all. That's not happened.
Zappa used like a Synclavier, and it was more kind of these weird disc formats, and maybe only one machine played this. He was very experimental. So that's, yeah, that's more of the digital end, but it sounds like, yeah, all the Queen stuff is in a position to be accessed.
Absolutely, yes. And the other thing to say, perhaps, on this is that Brian is a notorious collector. So he's not only has he collected all the Queen memorabilia like nobody else, he thought to keep all of that stuff, which has become such a precious resource. But he's kept the original tapes that he made even when he was a child. But not only did he keep the tapes, he kept the machine as well. So the original quarter-inch tape machine that he used to have at home when he was a small boy, that we have. So we don't have to go too far. Brian's kept most of the things we need. And if he hasn't, the Queen Productions machine, if you like, retains equipment as well. So we have more or less everything, and occasionally we have to go outside to find a machine. I think the furthest we've ever gone is we had to send a couple of tapes to the States to be transferred because they had the only machine that survived the last 35 years. So that's rare. That's a rarity.
How often do you discover new material out there? I imagine it was very frequent in the early days, but now with the internet and you've been at it for so long, do you still run across things of interest or recordings or video, or do you pretty much feel you've got, aside from a few things popping up now and again, you've pretty much got what's out there?
More or less got everything that's out there. There's always going to be the occasional thing that crops up, and invariably the people that approach us with it think it's far more valuable and precious than it is. So they may say, I've got a cassette here with some outtakes from the Miracle album in 88 or something like that. But we've already got it covered because it's a copy of a tape we already have. Or they might have an original cassette. It might have what would be referred to as overnight mixes, for example, from, say, let's say 84 or 82 Hot Space and the Works albums, but they're not that important. They're not that significant. A couple of years ago, I became aware of a TV report from 1979, for example, the European tour, where the band had done an interview as well as the report team shooting, I think, the first two songs of the show. And that was obviously very nice condition and sounded great, looked good. It's very rare, but it does happen. It happens probably on average about once every 3 years that someone comes along with something that is truly surprising, and we then would make efforts to purchase it or at least safety copy it. But it doesn't happen very often. Sometimes it's been the case that people that have worked for the band, even engineers, sometimes those guys have sadly passed and their estate has found some tapes in the garage or the attic, and suddenly there might be 5 or 6 very significant or quite significant recordings on the market, and we would go after them. But it isn't necessarily because we don't have that recording represented at all. It's just that it's a very good stereo analog reel or two, and it should rightly be in our archive.
Did Queen record pretty much everything? I mean, when you sat back and you listened to those hundreds of tapes, I imagine spending thousands of hours doing that. Could you hear the evolution of a song from its demo stages to rehearsals into maybe a false starts and outtakes and that sort of thing?
No, they didn't record everything. They didn't have the luxury of studio time, and because it was expensive, they more or less had to cut to the chase. It's certainly in the early days, they did that more so than in the latter years. So in the earliest recordings, yes, there are outtakes and false starts and various alternative versions, but you don't really get the evolution of the entire song. For example, you'd rarely hear a demo recording. By the time the tapes are rolling and they're recording, the song is pretty well rehearsed and progressed. So they're going to play through it a few times and then they're going to really start to hone it. But having said that, for every project, there are lovely outtakes and there is some different slants on familiar songs and some recordings of songs that didn't work or they didn't finish. And by the mid period, by which I mean Hot Space and The Works, right up to the last albums, there's more and more outtakes and more luxury of let's just keep the tape rolling and record whatever happens. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, absolutely it does. I mean, I imagine once they started getting their own studio, then they controlled the time, they controlled the resources. By then they were, you know, a worldwide sensation. They could afford to have that sort of indulgence. But for instance, have you heard early versions, perhaps unreleased early versions of things like Bohemian Rhapsody or Killer Queen, that sort of thing? Does that exist in the archive?
Well, just to give you a better picture or a broader picture, taking a project like Night at the Opera, there are many tapes, outtakes, piano outtakes, vocal outtakes, drum outtakes, and yes, there would be alternative versions of bow rap and rehearsal or discussion. So you can hear them, a little bit of banter talking about how I could do this or why don't you try this and maybe we could try this. You get a bit of that. There's certainly enough that you get a nice picture. You can sit there and visually picture what's going on. There's enough going on, you know, it's not brutally cut. You do hear enough of each song to get a very good idea of where they've come from, where they're going, and then ultimately they get where they need to be with it. And by that time, you feel like you've been with them over 4 days listening to this one song taking shape. So singling out Bohemian Rhapsody, not only on the master multitrack where there would be other vocal takes and other bits of guitar and drum and bass and piano and backing vocal, there would be other tapes as well with earlier versions, or there might be a tape that says Bohemian Rhapsody and the Prophet song, Freddie's Piano. So things like that exist and hopefully would form the basis of a Queen anthology at some point in the future. I'd like to think so anyway.
That would be fascinating to be able to see even an example of that with a song that's legendary like Bohemian Rhapsody or Bow Rap, as I guess you guys call it in the archive. Is there a possibility for that? Has there been discussion of that at some point?
There's been much discussion over my 20 years about anthology, especially when I first came on board back in the 1997-98 period, and Jim Beach would often say, give me your ideas, make some notes, tell me what shape you think anthology might take. So I would go away and come back with, well, we could do a 3-box thing, or maybe we could do a 5-box thing, We could do the early years, the middle years, and the later years, or we could do each album at a time. Or maybe we could do the first three Queen albums, and then when that's done, move on to the next three albums. So there's been various suggestions from myself and other people, and of course the band, for how we might go about putting together an anthology. But actually, in the last 5 or 6, 7 years, we haven't mentioned it. There's been too many other things going on. And I don't know how feasible anthology would be, because there's so many things in the archive that I might regard as fantastic and significant and interesting. The band members may think otherwise. They don't want that going out because that's not quite right or that's not ideal. Whereas I might be of the opinion, well, it is a rehearsal. It is an outtake. Does it have to be as perfect as the finished masters? So I really don't know if it would ever be feasible to do an anthology. But in terms of the material that we have in the archive, there's certainly enough. And it is extremely fascinating, most of it.
Let's talk about that, because there's been several projects that the archive has developed over the last few years. How does a project? Can you walk us through how a typical project comes together, how it's pitched, and maybe some of the twists and turns that it takes along its trajectory?
Okay, well, that varies from project to project. So, for example, Live at the Rainbow we did in 2014. I can't quite recall, but I think it would have been something like Jim gathering us together for a team meeting, and we all sit down and he will say something like, next year, 2014, what should we do? I want to do a live project or product, or I want to do a studio-based thing, or I want to do a box set. So he probably would have said something like, he and the band wants to do a live project. So then we would say that the small team of people would come back the next meeting and say, well, obviously next year, 2014, will be the 40th anniversary of 1974 or the 30th anniversary of 1984. We could do something for the Works, or we could do something from 74. We could do a Queen 2 or Sheer Heart Attack or Rainbow. So we ended up agreeing. The band liked the idea of doing the Rainbow because they'd always wanted to do it properly and get their teeth into it. So then we all go away. The audio boys look into exactly what exists and what doesn't exist. I go away, look at memorabilia and maybe what might be nice bonus material for that. Have we got any interviews from the time? Have we got rehearsal from the time? What have we got that could accompany this great audio and video? And also that entails me and Richard Gray looking at memorabilia. So we dig out the poster of the day and the laminate and the tour program and some magazines from the time and some badges, all those things that give a lovely flavor of the time. And all these component parts we work on over a year, something like a year in the case of the Rainbow. And everybody's doing their thing. And in the background, I'm thinking about sleeve notes and what text might be relevant. And we ask the band what they want in terms of text. And are they going to write something for it? And, you know, all of us work together, always in close contact with the band. And they will steer it and say, don't like that idea. And we do like that idea. And can you drop that and think more about this? And have you thought about this? And what are we going to do about that? And slowly and surely the project comes together. And in the case of the Rainbow, I think we produced a very beautiful product there in the vinyl box and the deluxe box and the CD and the DVD. Really a nice looking project that looked great, sounded great, and people responded to really well.
So in the case of the Rainbow, that seems to be you followed a thread and it developed, it matured. It did change a bit, but it's more of an evolution. Whereas when you look at something like Night at the Odeon, that seemed to be spurred on by a discovery, an unexpected discovery. Is that right?
Well, every project we take on changes hugely, and it always surprises me that the concept we originally go with changes so much. For example, we just did Queen on Air, all the Queen sessions and some interviews and some live recordings. And the project that was originally mentioned and described changed quite significantly. So by the time we reached the end, we came out with a project that none of us could really have foreseen. So that happens. That's always a nice surprise. I mean, the artwork surprised me, the white cover, which I think is very elegant and slick. That's unusual for Queen. We normally have a photograph of Freddie or the band on the front, and here we didn't, which is extremely unusual. Hammersmith, you mentioned, that was an example where the small team that we have here, and that is myself and Chris, Justin, and Richard, the audio guys were aware that we needed or would benefit from a better quality audio recording of Hammersmith. So I think it was Chris that made some inquiries and went looking for something better or something else anyway, just to compare with what we had. And he did find, I think via the BBC, a better recording. So those kinds of investigations do sometimes pay dividends. You know, it's worth looking. And we have found tapes in various places. I mean, Chris, I remember, found when he was in the States for something else some years back. He was trawling through an archive and happened to notice, I think it was an Under Pressure tape, an original tape from an American record label that had the A and B side of the Under Pressure single in a form that we didn't have. It was slightly better than what we had. So that really was quite a significant find. So things like that happen. Sometimes we do go looking for specific things, and sometimes we're not looking for a specific thing, but we can find something by accident. So all of those things happen.
What is an example of one of the most unexpected finds you've come across, perhaps from a source you didn't even know existed?
Do you mean within our own archive?
No, external, like a phone call. Did you guys, I have a copy of blah.
Well, I'd have to think about that. I think one of the surprises in recent years was when some actual multi-track tapes came onto the open market from News of the World. That was quite shocking to think that, because we were aware that we didn't have every single multi-track that one might expect for that album. And then suddenly a couple of tapes came up, because the Queen circle is wide. You can imagine on the internet, there's millions and millions of Queen fans. And if they hear of something interesting, they'll get word to us somehow. So it's unlikely that we'll miss big news like that. So it came to our attention, and we went after those tapes and got them back. Really, they should never have left the archive, but things happen. You've got a 30 or 40 year history for every tape, and sometimes a tape may be sent out and not come back, and nobody thinks to chase it. And only 30 years after the fact do you hear about this thing and you want it back. Yeah, think of that. In terms of interesting or shocking things, obviously that we have most of Queen's history right here in the archive. So when we were transferring tapes, and I was listening to them and logging them in detail, I remember being pretty taken aback and shocked in a really pleasant way by numerous recordings I heard. And one that sticks in my mind vividly is listening to Works outtakes one day, and then suddenly this song Let Me In Your Heart Again came on, which was amazing. You know, the whole band, a virtually finished song rather than fragments, which I was accustomed to hearing. Invariably you'll hear a fraction here and a fragment there, and it's unfinished or it's just an idea. But in this case, it was a finished song, near enough the final mix, Freddie singing, just a great song, which has in recent years been re-recorded or revisited and released. So you're probably aware, Nate, of the song I mean. And that was just amazing to hear that. That really was quite a moving experience to hear this unreleased gem that I could never have envisaged would be lurking on the end of a tape. And then to hear it in all its glory, with Freddie, fantastic voice, and the whole band in brilliant form, and a really good, powerful song with a strong lyric and a brilliant melody. That was a revelation.
Wow. Do you run across a lot of outtakes? Are there still a lot of unreleased Queen songs? I mean, which may be, you know, in various states of quality, I guess. Is there still a lot of stuff in the archive that is yet to be released?
I wouldn't say a lot, and I wouldn't say only a few either, somewhere in between. Many Queen fans know about the existence of some of this stuff because it has been bootlegged over the years, or partially. So, for example, there's quite a bit of material from Hot Space, The Works, The Miracle in particular, that has leaked, as it were, onto the open market. And there's some lovely ideas for songs like My Secret Fantasy, which people have already heard, and Face It Alone from Miracle. So there are some really nice ideas or partially finished songs that the band in theory could revisit, like they did for Made in Heaven. There's enough stuff there to make anthology really interesting, that's for sure. We wouldn't be hard pushed for enough material. We'd have more than we could feature on anthology, because there's so many studio albums, and I could probably get my hands on 4 or 5 hours of outtakes for each project.
All right, we're going to cut it off there, and we're going to pick it right back up here for part two, which should be available by the time you hear these words. Again, check your podcast app, iTunes, or thevinylguide.com, and enjoy the second part of our interview with Greg Brooks, official archivist for the band Queen. Cheers.